The immensity of the ships that have begun to call on our nation's ports is almost difficult to comprehend. The 2016 expansion of the Panama Canal has allowed larger and deeper drafting ships traveling from the Pacific and Indian Oceans to reach U.S. ports along the Gulf of Mexico and Atlantic seaboard. The expanded locks can now handle ships that are 1,200 feet long, 168 feet across the beam, and 190 feet tall. These floating behemoths are nearly as long as the Empire State Building laying on its side and can carry as much as 120,000 tons. When fully loaded, the bottom of their keel glides 50 feet beneath the sea surface. For most U.S. ports, accommodating these vessels also requires dredging navigation channels to make them deep enough to handle these super ships. Dredging is expensive, and maintaining channels to these immense depths is an additional annual expense for the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, or USAIS, which already spends about $1.6 billion each year to dredge the nation's waterways. Traditionally, dredging resources have been prioritized based on how much tonnage a port handles and on how deep the navigation channel is at its shallowest section. However, this methodology doesn't evaluate how much vessels are using the dredging USAIS provides. In a funding-constrained environment, managers need more data-driven tools to prioritize and optimize limited dredging dollars most efficiently.
Responding to this need, Burdick developed underkeel clearance, a new metric that directly measures how ships are using the depth that is currently available to them within U.S. navigation channels. Applying newly available ship location data from the Automatic Identification System, or AIS, and combining it with other data points, such as bathymetry and water level, provides insight on how often ship keels approach the bottom of a channel. This new metric, known as vessel encroachment volume, or VEV, describes the volume of a ship's hull that intrudes into a specified clearance margin above the channel bed. Underkeel clearance identifies channel restriction locations as well as areas where shoaling isn't impacting vessels. It provides USAIS waterway managers a new data-driven methodology to quantify channel maintenance requirements based on measured usage by transiting vessels, highlighting the areas that have the highest volume of ships with limited clearance.
I'm Megan Saxton, and with Chris Kiefer, this is The Power of Erdic. Our guests today are Dr. David Young and Dr. Brandon Scully, both research civil engineers at Erdic's Coastal and Hydraulics Laboratory. We will talk to David and Brandon about the new underkeel clearance metric and how it changes the paradigm for USAIS dredging decisions, helping waterway managers prioritize these services where they will have the greatest impact. Hey guys, thanks for being with us today.
Thanks for having us, Megan.
So let's start with walking through why this new metric is needed. How have dredging decisions traditionally been made, and what are the limitations of that methodology?
Sure, that's a great question. The Army Corps of Engineers has been involved in waterways since the early 1800s. And for a very long time, tonnage has been a metric, tonnage of cargo moved on ships has been a metric that has kind of driven the decision space for management of waterways. So when there's a lot of tonnage, waterways get maintained because that's where the tonnage is. And I mean, that's not the only metric, but it rewards projects for being large instead of putting maintenance funding and maintenance effort exactly where it needs to go. And the reason really is that there hasn't been a scalable technology that is capable of getting a better measure than tonnage.
So why is just looking at channel controlling depth not enough?
Sure. Channel controlling depth is the shallowest depth in a waterway. So the shallowest depth in a waterway is typically measured to the mean lower low water tidal datum, right? And that's just the low water that you can expect most of the time when the tide changes. And that's a really conservative way to look at the problem. And what happens is when the tide moves, that water, the available water depth gets deeper. So if you have, let's say, a 2 foot tide range like down in the Gulf, you may add 2 feet, whereas, you know, up in Alaska, there's a 30 foot tide range. So not everybody has the same benefit of tide. So that's one reason, is that tide is changing the available water depth. The other reason is that the location of that shoalest depth or the shallowest depth really, really matters. If that shoal is in the middle of the channel, it becomes problematic, but we very frequently see those shoals appearing on the edge of the channel. And so a large ship that can pass right by that shoal just by altering its course a tiny little bit isn't impacted. So just measuring that controlling depth, we may send dredging to a location where we can remove that impediment. I'm using air quotes here, that impediment without actually impacting navigability.
Sure. So Brandon, can you explain the underkill clearance metric and how it can improve that traditional decision-making?
Absolutely. We started with underkill clearance, which is the space between the keel of a ship and the top of the channel that it's navigating over, right? So the bed of the channel. And ideally, you want to have as much underkeel clearance, as much space between the bottom of a ship and the top of the channel bed as possible for safety's sake.
Mm-hmm.
But the counterpoint to that is that the larger a ship's load, the closer it needs to get to the bottom of the ship, right? So operators of vessels have to balance safety and economics or profit on their transits. So that's what we're looking at there. And that's why we focused on underkill clearance.
Another thing to consider here, Chris, is that from a water main management perspective, we obviously want vessels to have plenty of underkill clearance for safe transits, but also having deeper channels, those are more expensive to dredge. It makes them more costly to maintain. So there's a balance from the waterway management side as well with the vessel safety and the cost to maintain those channels.
Sure, you don't want to dredge just to dredge if it's not necessary.
Yep.
So, I mean, I guess part of what has enabled this is new technology and specifically AIS, which is the automatic identification system. Can you just talk a little bit about that and its implementation and how that has opened up new possibilities to analyze navigation systems?
Sure. The automatic identification system is an electronic system that is on marine vessels, and the purpose is to improve maritime domain awareness. And that means that vessels prior to AIS had a hard time knowing where other vessels were. So this helps avoid collisions. It helps vessels see further, perhaps, than the horizon to know where other vessels are. It's a radio technology. It's carried on the VHF, the very high frequency radio spectrum. But the Coast Guard records this data. So when a vessel pings its location, and it's doing that very frequently between every 2 seconds or every 3 minutes, depending on what the vessel is doing, it is recording that information, which we then have access to in a variety of ways. And we can look at an archive, right? So we are looking at years of data. We are looking at hundreds of ships, not just one ship, not in real time necessarily, but we are able to do analysis of large swaths of the maritime environment.
Mm-hmm.
You'll see AIS used fairly frequently, Chris, whenever there's some type of accident, like the Francis Scott Key Bridge collapse, you know, unfortunately, with the dolly.
Yeah.
You want to recreate what happened with that. The AIS messages can tell you that. So that's its original, you know, intended purpose, and we're just extending it to, you know, managing waterways.
Yeah, sure. Thanks, David. So based on that, how did this underkill clearance effort get started?
Right. So AIS has been around for a little while. We've been working with AIS specifically for at least 10 years now. It wasn't really wide scale adopted until after 9/11. It is mandated by law that vessels carry it. So we started to do the analysis when we realized that the vessels that are required to carry this technology really overlap with the Corps' mission, right? So very large commercial vessels, passenger vessels, tankers, cargo ships, et cetera. And so that gives us waterway domain intelligence that we've never had access to. And I started looking at this in, let's say, 2012, I think is when I got involved with AIS. And that's because I was working at the district, the Charleston district. I'm a former Charleston district employee. And I was interested in the movement of ships and how they impacted beaches. And I got to thinking that it was really more interesting to look at just the movement of ships and how they interact with the infrastructure that we're maintaining, because as a district employee, I was working on maintaining infrastructure. And so it's expanded from there. Ned Mitchell, who's a pretty key player in all things navigation in the Army Corps.
Also ERDC employee.
Also an ERDC employee, that's right. You know, we kind of met each other and he supported my work and we've kind of been in each other's orbit since, including, you know, my time through the district. And then, you know, he was kind of instrumental in helping me get a job at ERDC. We've been doing this for about 10 years now. And the technology itself, AIS, is out there, but the analytics portion is where we're really seeing benefit. Once a vessel shouts out into the void where it is, and for the most part, you know, other vessels see it and then they just keep, you know, making hay or whatever it is that they're doing. It's when we start to analyze these patterns, that's where the value starts to come from our perspective.
Sure. David, tell us more than, I guess, a specific metric that you all are using as part of this effort is called vessel encroachment volume. And I've seen, you know, you've used kind of different depth levels and whatnot. Can you, David, just talk about vessel encroachment volume and what it is and how you devise that methodology?
Yeah, certainly. The vessel clearance is very useful for looking at what individual ships are doing in the channel and tracking, you know, how much space they have and how safe and reliable those transits are. But, you know, the Corps is in charge of maintaining all navigable waterways. So there's like 25,000 miles of navigable waterways that we maintain. And we use a pretty straightforward racking and stacking approach to, you know, rank those navigable waterways, those ports, and try to decide where we're going to dredge. So we need metrics that can roll up into spreadsheets and describe what's going on in aggregate in your port or in your channel over a fiscal year when we're trying to make budget requests to OMB for the different work packages to dredge these channels. For that particular purpose, the undercube clearance of an individual vessel is obviously deficient. So we need a way to describe, in general, how close are vessels getting to the bottom of our channels. And so what we do is we came up with this parameter called the vessel encroachment volume metric. And what it does is it describes how close vessels get to within some specified offset distance of the bed. Two specified offset distances that we looked at were 2 feet and 5 feet. 2 feet comes from the PYANC recommendation for safe vessel transits in full depth channels. So PYANC is a international professional organization that governs maritime transit. They recommend 2 feet of vessel clearance in full depth navigation channels, which means ones that are dredged as deep as they say they are. And so anything with less than 2 feet of clearance is an unsafe, you know, vessel transit, according to our and according to PYANC's methodology. And our second level of clearance that we measure against is 5 feet of clearance. So how many vessels get within 5 feet of the bed? That's not supported by any type of recommendation from PYANC, but is instead based on some work that we did previously in Southwest Pass. So the way the vessel encroachment volume metric works is we basically measure how much of the vessel hull gets within 2 feet or 5 feet of the bottom of the channel. And the advantage this has over simply figuring out like how much of the shoal is in the way of vessels is that it incorporates the effect of multiple transits. So you can imagine that if you have a shoal in the channel that, and a shoal, by a shoal, I just mean that a place where the water depth is shallower than the maintained depth by the Corps, but only one vessel has to transit or navigate around or over that shoal. That shoal may not be as much of a concern as a shoal that might be smaller, but let's say 1,000 vessels have to transit over that shoal. So it's a shoal that's impacting a lot of traffic. And this metric incorporates that effect. So the effect of how many vessels have an issue with this particular shoal in the channel.
And it's also the volume of the ship that is passing over the shoal too, correct?
Yes, the volume of the vessel hull that gets within 2 feet of the shoal or within 5 feet of the shoal, and that allows us to incorporate the size of the ship, right? So if it's a humongous container ship or tanker ship, it's going to count more than your grandpappy's fishing boat.
Yeah, sure.
I want to point out that PYANC actually stands for the Permanent International Association of Navigation Congresses, or at least it did. They changed their name to the World Association for Waterborne Transport Infrastructure, and the Army Corps of Engineers is a charter member.
Okay.
Did you discover any surprises once you began analyzing underkeel clearance data?
We did. And, you know, that was exciting for us. kind of the big one is that vessels traveling over accumulated sediment tended to have more underkeel clearance instead of less. And we thought that was interesting because, you know, it seems like these vessels are self-selecting. A shallow drafting vessel sees that there's a shoal on the edge of the channel and it's not at risk of hitting the bottom. And so they can stay out of the way of these larger vessels that generally, you know, are navigating constrained to the navigation marks, right? So the ranges on a channel are tend to be in the center. That's where we tend to see the vessels navigating. So that was kind of interesting, although we kind of expected that the large vessels would follow those navigation ranges. And then the other thing that we saw is that, you know, when you break it down, the Army Corps of Engineers essentially were providing depth. The service that we're providing is depth. And when a vessel transits within 2 feet of the bottom, that's a, if we call that a safe transit, right? And we are not saying, you know, we're not making a recommendation on what is safe, but we are saying that 2 feet is advised by PNG. We're spending between $0 and $1.6 million to provide that safe transit. And so that's an interesting finding for our research. It's six orders of magnitude cost difference for essentially the same thing. And so somebody may look at that and say, is that justified or what is the justification? And so that's kind of a neat finding that, you know, opens up some interesting management questions, I think.
Yeah. What areas have you all studied so far applying this metric, and kind of where are some of the other biggest areas that you kind of want to look at?
Yeah, that's a good question, Chris. So we have done a reimbursable project for the South Atlantic Division. And most of the numbers that we talked about this far come from the South Atlantic Division ports that we've studied. But the goal is to operationalize this for every single navigation channel all across the Corps. So every single one in the country that we maintain, so that when we're racking and stacking these different projects and these different ports, we're uniformly applying it everywhere. And we can get a good sense for what areas need more dredging dollars, what areas have a lot of vessels that are impacted by the shoaling that's present in their channels, and, you know, conversely, what areas perhaps don't see a lot of impacts to the vessels that happen to be in their navigation channels.
Sure. And I guess building on that, as this tool is incorporated, how do you see it changing USAFE's dredging operations and decision-making?
Well, the point of the analysis is to identify locations where dredging can be reduced without impacting navigation safety, right? The Army Corps of Engineers spends $1 billion to $1.5 billion every year dredging. And so it's typical when you have a key performance indicator evolution to have found money, found savings in the budget, right? That's why these things happen in management. And so we're working with this concept that 10% of that budget can be freed up to do other things. So if dredging could be reduced in a particular location, under this condition where we are not impacting navigation safety, then we can reallocate that 10% and maintenance funds can be spent in locations that are under maintained, because there are, because of typical historical budget constraints, there are projects that are not being maintained to the extent that they could benefit. This lets us go further down the list, right? And it's really a coup for the mid-tier ports, right? Where all of our really large ports, everybody knows that there's going to be a lot of traffic. So any kind of shoal that appears there, there's going to be a lot of a relatively high VEV, that vessel encroachment volume. So we don't suspect that the big ports are going to all of a sudden get impacted severely. But what we do think is that we may find savings in some of those larger ports, and that may support some of those mid-tier ports and even some of the smaller ports. So that's how we think that we're going to be able to do more within our current budget.
I've heard you explain that underkeel clearance allows waterway managers to look at dredging decisions through the lens of supply and demand. Can you elaborate on that a little bit?
Yeah, certainly. Thanks, Megan. The whole idea behind this is that the Corps of Engineers up until now has looked at the supply of available depth in the channel. So if you were looking at a navigation channel, we survey those navigation channels regularly. I think we're mandated to survey them once a year, but in some places like Southwest Pass, we survey the navigation channel every single day. We also know what the water level is in that navigation channel from the NOAA tide gauges. So if you think about available depth as a product that the Corps of Engineers provides, we know how much of that product we supply because we know how much we're dredging, We know how deep the water is from the survey and the water level. And so we know our supply of this product of depth that we provide. However, circling back to Brandon's answer about tonnage many questions ago, tonnage doesn't describe how ships actually use that product, how they use the available depth. It has nothing to do with how deep vessels are drafting, particularly, that's not true. I guess for an individual ship, it does have to do with how deep they're drafting. But frequently you can move large amounts of tonnage on barges, which draft very shallowly, like 10 feet. And so in certain places, you have a channel depth of 40 feet, but if, you know, 90% of your tonnage is moving on these barges, you know, a 10-foot drafting barge is never going to use up an appreciable amount of your supply of available depth that you have, right?
Yeah.
So the vessel clearance then comes back in and looks at the demand. So what is the demand for that available depth on the part of your vessels that are navigating in your channel, right? So if this is a hyperbolic example, but to extend upon that barge traffic example, if instead your tonnage is primarily being moved on bulk carriers, let's say, and all of them are, you know, scraping the bottom of the channel, you know, with 6 inches of clearance coming into port, you know, those vessels are clearly demanding a large amount of the supply of service that we provide. So in that sense, we're trying to think of available depth as a supply demand curve. So we have a supply of things, a supply that we provide through our dredging, and then what is the demand for that available depth on the part of vessels in our channels.
And so that way you're sending the supply to where the demand is the highest.
Yeah, exactly.
Sure. What are some other capabilities or use cases for this data?
That's a good question. One of the other things that tonnage doesn't necessarily do is target the items that are kind of enumerated in the navigation mission, right? So the Army Corps has a navigation mission. It's to provide safe, reliable, efficient, effective, and environmentally sustainable waterway service here. So tonnage doesn't really hit those, right? So we are directly measuring essentially a metric of safety. And by putting it in terms of unsafe transits relative to total transit population, that's an efficiency metric, right? And we can determine how effective we're being by seeing how well we align the supply and the demand. By minimizing the amount of dredging that we do that doesn't directly contribute to that effectiveness, that makes our program more environmentally sustainable. If you think about, you know, moving sediment, not only removes the sediment from the waterway, potentially it removes it from the sediment system, the littoral system, which is a big part of the recent effort in the Corps is to sustainably manage our sediment.
Mm-hmm.
And so then we avoid all the other things that come along with managing sediment, right? So we're avoiding emissions, potentially. We are not putting this stuff potentially in an upland placement area. We're taking it offshore. There's a lot of benefit environmentally to putting the right amount of dredging in the right location.
Yeah.
So this metric basically targets everything in the navigation mission in a way that hasn't previously been done.
How does this tool enable studies on how waterway traffic has changed over time, such as before and after a waterway modification?
So the Army Corps has a couple of studies that if you look through the literature where they try to measure navigation changes or changes to the infrastructure. And prior to the advent of AIS, the way that you would do this is to put researchers on an individual ship, usually three or four of them with a GPS unit and track the movement of a vessel. And so you can imagine A, that that's very expensive. And then B, that one ship, unless you spend a lot of money, is statistically insignificant. And then other ways would be like to look at ships moving in a waterway using a video system, which has its own problems. If you have adverse weather conditions, there's all kinds of reasons why that becomes problematic.
Yeah.
But the thing about AIS is that it scales, right? It doesn't cost us anything really to get this data. The ships are just putting it out there. You know, yeah, there's some incidental costs for like getting it from the Coast Guard and putting it on your computer, but it's orders and orders of magnitude less than doing research with equipment, right? And so, like I said, this data has only been available for the last 20 years or so. And the Marine Cadastre AIS data set, which is something we've leaned on heavily, it's an archive for the whole country at 1 minute increments, is put together by NOAA and the Bureau of Ocean Energy Management, BOEM. And that really only goes back to about 2009. So it's really very recent. If you consider the rate at which harbor deepening or these major engineering changes happen, it's really very recent. We now are in a phase where we have data that overlaps both before and after, because you need several years of data before and several years of data after to get a statistically meaningful assessment of what the result has been. And so we're approaching that. And I think that's really kind of a very neat thing, because, you know, generally these projects are planned and then they're executed and then, you know, they're planned again and then executed again. And there's rarely a check back. We just look and we say that the benefits are going to be large, therefore we're going to improve the project. And we haven't necessarily shown how the waterway operators have changed their behavior following these studies.
Another thing, Chris, is this is very timely now with the Panama Canal having been deepened and your vessels coming into or trying to come into these East Coast ports. Some of the East Coast ports have been deepened already within the past, you know, 4 or 5 years. And most other ports on the East Coast are under some type of study to consider deepening those ports. And this type of analysis is something that, you know, we think could tell us what was the effect of having deepened the ports that already have been deepened. And at least consider, you know, beforehand, are the vessels that are in those ports now using all the depth that we provide them at the current time, and how will that change in the future?
I'll add that the original conception of this started with underkill clearance, because that's kind of the most critical. But as these ships have gotten larger, the lateral clearances, we call it the XY clearance, that's also very important. And from some preliminary stuff that we've looked at, it's almost as if the XY clearance resolution can predict where the channel widenings are going to be necessary. And so, you know, as these vessels get bigger, as they get closer and closer to things that you don't want them to come close to, we should be able to see that in the data,
yeah,
right? And that should help guide further discussion about where, you know, widening is necessary or band easing or whatever you're talking about.
Can each of you talk a little about your backgrounds and how you came to be involved in this effort?
Sure. I'll go first. I graduated from the Coast Guard Academy, class of 2003, so just over 20 years ago. And I went, you know, the Coast Guard Academy, you are taught professional navigation. They teach you how to drive ships. And then I went from the academy as an engineer on a 378-foot ship was my first tour.
Yeah.
And I learned how to actually drive large ships. I was very fortunate. I guess it's an exciting thing to drive something so large. And then from that job, I went to buy aids to navigation for the Coast Guard. Eventually, I wound up at the Charleston District. As I mentioned, I started off as a staff engineer in the navigation section. So I was planning dredging jobs. And then I was promoted to be the chief of navigation for the Charleston District. And that, you're really in the weeds on how maintenance decisions are made. And it was kind of in parallel with those two jobs, right? The staff engineer and the chief of navigation, that I was going to night school to get my PhD. And, you know, that's when I kind of formulated my dissertation topic, which was reliably managing waterways using this underkill clearance metric. And I'll let David tell his story, but I was very fortunate to find him early on in my research career, and we've been working together ever since.
Building on that point, I want David to get into his story in just a second, but Brandon, the experience you've had both in terms of, you know, actually physically, you know, driving ships and then managing a navigation channel, how is that kind of uniquely fed into this effort is really what I'm asking, but, you know, has it kind of enabled you to look at things maybe a different way because of those two very unique experiences, but both feed into this pretty directly?
Yes. I think it's really just a super niche role, right? If you go to any civil engineering school, and I started out as a mechanical engineer. So, but if you go to any civil engineering school, you're going to learn transportation and you're going to learn it via the highways or maybe railroads. There's not a real big community of marine transportation engineers in the United States, right? Across all of the, if you look at all of the colleges, there's only a handful. And so starting out on a ship, driving a ship, learning how to drive a ship, then dealing with aids to navigation, then dealing with channel maintenance, it's almost like it's a really, a very rare needle to thread, right? I guess, to come up with that specific set of skills.
Yeah. David, tell us about your story and background and how you came to be involved with this.
Mine's not nearly as interesting as Brandon. I got my PhD at Georgia Tech, and I was hired by ERDC. There wasn't much of a, you know, a plan for me when I started out. So I was just sitting there in my office one day, waiting on my computer to show up and, you know, twiddling my thumbs. And Brandon came and plucked me out of the muck to come work on this. I think the first thing we actually did was digitizing the chief's reports. But then I started working on this AIS data with him, and the rest is history. Now I'm here.
I know you're being humble. Brandon, tell us about what David has brought to this effort.
First of all, David's a PhD from Georgia Tech. That's kind of a big deal. And he was studying hydrodynamics of marine invertebrate in the swash zone, if I'm correct. So super hardcore mathy stuff. But it's easy for me to look at, he's tracking the trajectory essentially of individual items, water bugs. But there's not really a difference from tracking the trajectory of individual water bugs to tracking the trajectory of the individual vessels, right? Mm-hmm. It's the same skill set.
It's actually easier because they mostly only move in 2D, the ships, you know?
Yeah, so he's being humble, but I didn't snatch him up out of the muck. He was the right man for the job, and I got lucky.
Yeah. Tell us, we obviously talked about kind of what each of you have brought to this project individually, but talk about how ERDC is uniquely positioned to do this research and how much it's kind of leveraged ERDC's competencies and historic expertise.
Yeah, that's a good point, Chris. So Brandon already talked pretty extensively about our experience with navigation, and the Coastal Hydraulics Lab has a lot of expertise with navigation and dredging. And, you know, Brandon's time at Charleston District gave us a good sense for how the districts operate when it comes to making these dredging decisions. But one thing we haven't talked about, and it's certainly a big deal, is how large these data sets are. So, you know, the AIS data for the entire country is something like 40 terabytes. We're trying to get all the NOAA tide gauges so that we can match up the water levels. The survey data for the channel condition surveys and pre and post dredging surveys for every single navigation channel in the entire Corps of Engineers is a huge amount of data. And we're talking about hundreds of terabytes of data just with that. The interest in clearances draft data to try to figure out what the draft of the ships is. So it's hard to manage it. It's hard to process it in a way that is quick and easily digestible. So when we started out, we leaned very heavily on our collaborators at ITL. Dr. James Ross has been a big help to us for trying to parallelize our computations using the HPC. So when we started out doing this work and we realized just how big of an undertaking it was, that sort of got our feet wet for, you know, looking at alternative computational methods. And we've since moved to the cloud, actually. So we're working with Mobile District's Geospatial Data Branch in Microsoft Azure. So we've moved our processing to the cloud and using some other data science tools. Like we're using their Elasticsearch database of vessel data. They also have the surveys loaded up in Elasticsearch database, which allows us to very rapidly query this information so that we can quickly compute these numbers on the fly for a tool for our districts. But it's been a big collaborative effort.
Yeah.
I just think it's cool to say we started on a supercomputer.
Absolutely. And, you know, it's amazing on that point. And I know Megan will concur on this, but it feels like almost every episode, you know, there's some, you know, another project that the supercomputers have enabled. And it's kind of really neat. And we actually had that. Listeners can go back a few episodes where we talked to Dr. Ben Parsons talking about the supercomputing research center that's hosted here at ERDC. But it's really neat, you know, all the things that it enables.
Absolutely. We would not be able to even South Lake Division is too much to do on a person's standard laptop or workstation. So we wouldn't be nearly as far along as we are without their help.
What does the future hold for this effort?
So I mentioned very briefly at the end of that last question that we have migrated to using Microsoft Azure. And the reason for that is that we are integrating this tool into the NAB portal. And the NAB portal is this big effort that's funded by a congressional ad that is supposed to be a one-stop shop for all of the navigation data and tools that the Corps of Engineers has produced over the years. So it's going to have, I'm going to name drop some tools, but the hydro data, which is all the surveys that the Corps has collected, CSAT, which is the shoaling analysis tool. So like how quickly do these different channels shoal in? ASAP, which is an AIS analysis package, is in there. And this effort is slated to be integrated into NAB portal in the next fiscal year. The goal of all of this is, you know, it's nice for us to be able to do this research and to write papers about it and stuff. But ultimately, we're trying to transition this to a tool that people at headquarters or people at division or people at individual districts or even individual projects can use to see what's going on with vessels in their channels. How close are they getting to the bottom? Are they having issues? Brandon, I don't want to steal his thunder, but he's also working on integrating crowdsourced bathymetry so that we can take this from a historical look back of vessel clearance to a near real-time measurement of what's going on with the vessels that are in your channel right now. Like, what is the clearance issues that they're having right now? So the goal for this effort and the future for this effort is to take this from a research tool to a tool that can be used by anyone who has a CAT card and wants to go in and figure out what's going on with ships in their channels.
I'll add to that. First of all, where this is going, we never would have gotten out there without the Coastal Inlets Research Program, which has funded a substantial amount of this work over the last 5 or so years, maybe longer. And then the second part is that David's talking about bringing this from a historic look back to a near real-time technology. One of the things that's important to understand is how the federal budget works, right? So a decision maker now or a maintenance manager now is asking through the work package process for maintenance funds 2 years from now in the future, right? So we are going to say, I want to dredge channel X 2 years from now. So they have to put in their budget request. Mm-hmm. And as it stands, they're using data that is the tonnage data or whatever other data that we're using is about a year or 2 years old. Okay. That's just how the process works. Mm-hmm. And so there's essentially a 4-year information gap or a 3-year information gap, right? So if we can take this to even a week, let's say instead of real time, we get, you know, a week old data, we've reduced the data window, if you will, from 4 years or 3 years down to about 2 years. I mean, that's substantial, right? We're making better decisions and asking for funds with better information.
Yeah.
And I think that's, we can't really overstate the importance of that. And that's kind of my vision for how this works in the future.
Excellent. So that'll be exciting to see. And thank you guys for coming on today and discussing it and explaining it. I guess it probably falls into one of those topics, except for, say, navigation managers, not something people think about a lot. But I think as you know, as they kind of listen to this discussion and kind of where it's going and kind of see the importance and the impact it can have on something that, you know, is so critical to the U.S. economy. So thank you guys for the work you're doing. And thanks for taking the time to discuss it today.
Sure. I appreciate the opportunity to talk about our work. We think it's really important.
Thanks very much for having us, Chris.
Given that ships can move enormous quantities of goods and that more than 70% of the Earth is covered by water, shipping lies at the heart of global commerce. U.S. ports move more than 90% of U.S. imports and exports and support more than $4.6 trillion in yearly economic activity. USAIS is charged with designing and maintaining the coastal and inland waterways that connect these ports to the open ocean. This includes dredging navigation channels to ensure deep drafting vessels are able to safely transit. USAIS spends roughly $1.6 billion annually on dredging, an expense that grows as ships draft at even greater depths. By more accurately measuring how much demand vessels actually have for these dredging services, underkeel clearance will allow waterway managers to more efficiently allocate limited funding to best execute this critical mission.
The Power of Arctic podcast is a production of the U.S. Army Engineer Research and Development Center. Follow Arctic on LinkedIn, Facebook, and X, formerly known as Twitter, for the latest information. You can listen to the Power of Arctic podcast on all major podcast players. Visit powerofarcticpodcast.org for more resources. You can also contact us at powerofarcticpodcast@usace.army.mil. That's all for today. We'll see you next time.